You're listening to the Velo News Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.
Hello, I'm Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
Daniel Freeb.
Hello.
And Matt Bowden.
Hello. Bonjour.
And this is the fourth Velo News Cycling Tour de France podcast supported by Jaguar. We're down to one Velo News member, Andy Hood. We got a bit too close to Spain, didn't we? And it sucked him back. He lives in Spain. Is that what happened? Has anyone seen Andy Hood?
No one's seen Andy Hood, okay? I haven't really seen the real Andy Hood in weeks. He's been on tour. He's been a madman. He's a shapeshifter, that one.
Do you miss him?
Absolutely. Of course I miss him. It's like my road captain's been plucked off the road. Now I'm just wandering around attacking aimlessly.
You do look a little bit lost, although you have got Kayleigh Fretz with you, who's the technical editor at Velo News, and we're going to speak to him later. He's off sniffing around all these time trial bikes, because we're at the start of the time trial in Bergerac, and this is a podcast that will be recorded over about 48 hours or so. It won't last 48 hours. It'll just be recorded over that period of time. We're at the start of the time trial in Bergerac. We're standing by the Garmin Sharp team bus. Matt, have you observed, witnessed anything interesting this morning?
No, it's been very quiet, you know, because right now we're so far before the main GC guys will go that I think a lot of these guys are just put their headphones on and try to get it out of the way. And one more day to Paris. I think that's the feeling you see now. The mechanics tinkering away, the endless tinkering. I like that about time trials. They're sort of metronomic in their like preparations. You see the guys around the bus and just doing every little detail possible, and they're sort of quiet compared to a regular road start because it comes in intervals, and you can observe a lot. Sometimes it's hard to do some reporting because everybody's pretty focused, but you know, today's just, it seems like any other.
We spoke about this time trial, Matt, yesterday. This will be broadcast after the time trial, so let's put your predictions to the test here. The real battle is, of course, not for the yellow jersey. Vincenzo Nibali should win the Tour. I think he'll hold on to his 5-minute odd lead today in the time trial. Is how
seven
minutes.
Seven.
I switched off for the last couple of minutes. It's a 7-minute lead. But who's going to finish on the podium, Matt, and in what order?
Oh, geez. You know what? I'm going to be vague here. I'm going to say Valverde and a Frenchman. How about that? I think Valverde does a good ride today. Of course, I could be wrong, but I'm always wrong. Like, if I predict something to happen, that person crashes out of the race. I wrote a season predictions column maybe like 6 months ago. I think I'm gonna go back and revisit it after the tour, but I'm not sure that I got a single thing right. So you really can't ask me anything. The only thing we do know is Nibali will win the tour. Personally, I hope he just like ghost rides his bike at the finish line and walks across.
Odd mood, Matt, isn't he? The tour's taking its toll. He's a husk of a man.
You know, I can't speak to that. If you observe something,
bring back hoodie. We need. His muse has left him, and he's obviously feeling the absence quite keenly.
To that, I would say it's a long tour. More of a GC man. It's taking its toll on me, that's for sure. But it's been. I think it's been much quieter than recent tours. Don't you? It's not. It hasn't been as hectic. It hasn't been as, maybe, we didn't have any real scandals the last two tours, but it seems like this one has been very, very subdued.
It's sort of, it felt like it's almost petered out a little bit. There was that huge start in Yorkshire, which seems like a million years ago, and yet at the same time, quite recently, it's weird that the tour seems to have gone pretty fast for me this year, but yet Yorkshire does seem like a long time ago, and in terms of, you know, the we're at the stage start here, the crowds are pretty thin as they wander around the buses. They're not huge. Yorkshire would have been squeezed in there. Perhaps they should hold the finish in Yorkshire in some future year.
You Brits.
That'd be controversial.
You Brits. Just angling for a home race. The French tell you to get your own race. It is quiet, and I wonder if that's due to crowd control, because it seems like ASO this year, the tour organizers, have been much more strict about where the road closures are, and they're shutting things down further away from cities, and it makes it easier for the journalists and for the teams, probably, but I think it does certainly have an impact on the amount of fans that can get to a given start.
Well, we're standing at the Garmin Sharp bus, and earlier on, Lionel, you and I spoke to Jonathan Vauters, general manager, who's been a sort of irregular presence on the race. He was here for a bit at the start, then he drifted off, and he came back again just in time for the stage win on Friday for Navardauskas. So let's hear what Jonathan Vauters has had to say this morning. You've been on the tour for a bit of the tour and away from the tour for a bit. I gather meeting with some sponsors, potential sponsors. Is this with a view to securing the future of the team?
I mean, most of those negotiations have already happened and are just sort of in the final phases of being announced. We're not going to announce it for a couple more weeks, but no, that's that. I was just off entertaining more than actually negotiating.
And was some good entertaining had by all?
Oh yeah, some excellent entertaining was had by all. Yeah,
riding your bike a bit as well, I think.
I have been riding my bike a bit as well. Yeah, I went up the Col de Fourclaz right outside of Annecy. That's really hard. I forgot how hard, like a really hard climb like that was. You know, it's not the same thing as just riding a couple hours around parks and whatnot in Denver. It's freaking hard, steep, sweaty.
So back to the tour. You obviously had your stage win yesterday. Does that mean that this is you've had disappointments at this tour, obviously, especially with the loss of Andrew Talansky? And I know the team came into the tour with a plan to really support his GC ambitions. But does the stage win yesterday, does that salvage the tour from your point of view?
I mean, listen, the biggest thing that I was happy about in this tour is that after Andrew left, the team dynamic remained good. Because, you know, 9 times out of 10, when something like that happens, it just really falls apart and everyone drops their shoulders and drops their heads and just isn't that motivated anymore. But these guys stuck together. They stuck together. They stayed focused. And every day that we had a chance to win, you know, we really came up with a plan that gave us a shot. And they tried 100% every day that we had a chance. And at first it didn't work out. It was a little awkward. You could tell they weren't, you know, changing from all we're doing is supporting one guy, nothing else, to okay, now we got to get in breakaways to try to, you know, win a stage. Didn't really work that well at first. A little bit awkward, but each day it was sort of getting a little bit closer, a little bit closer, a little bit closer, and then, you know, finally it worked.
Where were you the day Jack Bauer almost won? Were you in front of a TV somewhere?
Yeah. I watched it on TV. I was actually with with the principal owner of Slipstream Sports, Doug Ellis, and he and I were watching, and that was a heartbreaker.
Should he have been wearing an aero helmet that day?
Yeah, exactly. You go into all those details like, oh gosh, maybe if he would have thrown his water bottle like 5K earlier.
Now, Navardauskas was obviously a late call up to the tour team, replacing David Miller, which got you some criticism in some quarters, especially from Scotland, obviously. But was it particularly satisfying that he was able to sort of justify that faith that you put in him?
I mean, you know, end of the day, I would have been just as happy if any of the guys would have won. He just happened to be the best guy for that particular course that day, and we utilized what we had at our disposal.
And what about Talansky? Have you been in contact with him? How is he recovering from his wounds, and what's next for him?
He's recovering well. He's going to do the Vuelta. I don't think he'll quite be in the same form of the Vuelta as he was, at the start of this race, but he'll be there. I think psychologically it's been pretty tough for him because, he's looking at the list and the top 10 guys going, well, wait a minute. I've been consistently very competitive with all these guys for a while now, and I think he really sees that he could have had a great Tour de France, but at the end of the day, it just wasn't meant to be. So I think psychologically it's been rough on him. Physically, he's healing. He's just started training again now. And so, I think he'll be good at the Vuelta. Maybe not great, but good.
You're listening to the VeloNews Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.
Okay, welcome back to VeloNews Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar. We're here with Matt Bowden in Bergerac. And Matt, just looking back at the tour, any moments stand out for you?
For me, it's the cobbled stage. It's probably for a lot of people, it's the cobbled stage. I thought it was a really visceral expression of pure racing, and I love that. And I think at this point the issue's been put to bed over, should we have had the cobbles or not, because Nibali,
who's not here anymore, and he can't argue against
guy. He can't defend himself, can he? It was everything you wanted to see. It was exciting. It was like a desperate hill climb for 2 hours. So I think that was what I will take with me from this tour. Absolutely, yeah.
We witnessed a conversation happening earlier, didn't we, Lionel, as we walked past the Katusha bus, Frankie Andrew, and Vyacheslav Ekimov. And we thought that was a... I wonder, to be a fly on the wall, that conversation, I wonder what was being said between those two.
Frank will probably fill us in later, won't he?
We'll ask him, shall we?
Yeah. Ekimov was talking with... was usually locked in conversation with Sergei Uchakov earlier, who is... He's one of the really colourful characters on the tour. Lionel, you're probably well placed to introduce, to tell us a bit more about Uchakov.
He looks, from his expression and the colour of his skin, colour of his skin and the way his hair just waves perfectly back, it does look like he's looked into the heart of a nuclear reactor for a split second.
Yeah, having dressed up as Michael Douglas in Romancing in the Stone.
What an image. But that is exactly what he looks like. He beat Lance Armstrong semi-famously, didn't he, in a tour stage, out-sprinted him. Not a million miles from here. Was that in Revel?
Before he won in Limoges Armstrong, which I think you're heading to Limoges tonight, actually, Lionel, aren't you, on your way up to Paris? That Armstrong took that very badly, that defeat in 95, I remember.
There was an American link. There was an American link to that. Well, we had Andre talking to Ekimov, and then we had Uchakov beating Armstrong. So, everything... Everything flows seamlessly.
American flavour, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, bend to fit.
What's next for you, Matt, from here? Where do you go from here?
I'll go to Paris and work on my magazine stuff and fly home on Wednesday to beautiful Boulder, Colorado.
Any exciting plans for when you get home?
We have the tour of Colorado. Yeah. We have that in August. And then after that, it's sort of mellow for me until the next race season starts. I'll do some cross stuff and
It's always mellow for you, Matt. You're not known as Mellow Matt for nothing.
Is that what you call me? Do you call me Mellow Matt? That can't possibly be.
Yeah, we do. Where's Mellow Matt? Has anybody seen Mellow Matt? That's the cry that goes around the press room. let's talk about an American that we haven't spoken about all tour, Chris Horner. 42 years old. Is he 43 yet? Must be.
42. He will be 43 in the fall, I believe, but he's 42 currently.
And he's riding the Vuelta again, obviously. Now, what have you made of his performance at this tour? We saw him briefly on the Hautecam stage, didn't we? He escaped briefly with Vincenzo Nibali. Have you spoken to him much, Matt? Do you know where he's at in terms of his form?
Yeah, I've spoken to him a few times, actually. I think he told me more than once he's really happy with where he's at physically as far as the legs go, but he's been very sick, as you know. Half the peloton's been on antibiotics, chest infections. So I think he said he feels really good for maybe 5 minutes, but then just kind of fades away. But I think if he gets through the tour, he told me if he recovers well, gets to train in the heat. Chris Horner loves the heat, total weirdo. But he'll be really good for the Vuelta. He seems to think so. And he's straight shooter. So if he says he's going to be good, he's probably going to be good.
Well, we can hear a little bit from Chris Horner.
We should hear from him now because Johan van Summeren is warming up in front of us here, and he unusually, perhaps uniquely, he's not wearing headphones and he's turning around quite a lot to listen into the podcast. I'm a bit worried that he leaks some of this exclusive content before it's actually broadcast. So we better go straight to the Chris Horner interview. I think you spoke to him, Lionel.
Yeah, I spoke to him. I forget where we were now. It was a day or so ago. We're in France somewhere. Chris Horner was just getting ready to go to the start, and I grabbed a quick word with him, and as you'll hear, he explained a bit about his illness. He put that down not just to the bad weather affecting everybody's lungs, but also the cobbled stage, and just he feels that breathing in a lot of muck and dirt has just agitated his lungs, and he thinks that's a contributory factor to a lot of riders suffering from illness. But at the end, I asked him whether he was shooting for the podium again in the Vuelta, and he left me in no doubt as to what his goal is there. Can you sum up how your tour has been going? I know it's nearly over. We haven't caught up with you yet, so sum it up.
Yeah, well, I was sick from stage 5, so the rest of the time has just been trying to survive through the mountain stages and then start to find some lungs again. So yesterday is a little bit better, but honestly, the weather's been so bad the whole time, it makes it hard to clear up the lungs when it's so much rain and humidity and stuff. So it's been a good tour in general, though. Could be better if I was healthy, of course, but it is what it is.
Is that noticeable this year? A lot of guys are sick, and is that because of the weather then?
Yeah, I think the weather, of course, the cobblestone day, throws up a lot of stuff in the lungs, and you swallow a lot of stuff, so it's easy to get sick that day. But yeah, clearly a lot of guys are, so you go back home, heal up, and head on to the next race.
You showed on Hotacam that you had pretty good legs yesterday, but it didn't quite work out. What did you make of Nibali when he came with you and then passed you?
Yeah, he's got form, there's no doubt about that. He's riding 100%, and he's healthy still. He hasn't had any illness or anything, so he's got... Clearly, he's riding well and strong, and so barring any kind of real accident, he should be good to go for the win, unless he crashes or something strange like that.
It's a great unknowable, but do you think he would have won if Froome and Contador had not crashed out?
He had the leader's jersey to begin with, but nobody knows the answer to that, so you just have to see.
And lastly for you, will you be going to the Vuelta as the defending champion? Do you think you can, if you can get... healthy, get back to full strength, another shot at the podium?
Yeah, another shot at the win, so that's the plan. So we'll see what happens, come out of here and get healthy, and then focus on the Vuelta.
You're listening to the Bello News Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.
Okay, I'm with Kaylee Fretz, the noise of turbo trainers spinning in the background. Johan van Summeren is still warming up there. And Matt Bowden is still here. Kaylee Fretz, the technical editor at Bello News. Kaylee, you've been a busy man this morning, sniffing around all these time trial bikes.
Yes.
This is like your Christmas, isn't it?
It's Christmas. I actually flew all the way back from Colorado for this stage and tomorrow. It's Christmas for a tech guy.
Seen any nice presents out there?
There's a brand new Bianchi called the Aquila CV. Uses some of the technology that they debuted in the Roubaix bike. It's called Countervail. Basically makes a more comfortable frame. Looks really slick. Other than that, there's not a whole lot of new stuff out here today. Tony Martin's bike, he's on some interesting gearing. He's actually running what a couple years ago would have been a mountain bike cassette, the 32-tooth big cog, and that's so he can stay in the big ring for the entire stage today.
Wow. Does that not have alignment issues? Or
a couple years ago, there would have been alignment issues. The derailleur, he's running a long cage rear derailleur, which is part of the SRAM Wi-Fi system, and...
I'm really nervous interviewing you, Kaylee, because I know nothing about tech. I'm worried I'm going to say something really stupid.
No, you're fine.
We were talking at breakfast this morning a bit over coffee, as we do, and Kaylee had mentioned that Tony Martin is going to run a clincher, which is interesting because pretty much everyone thinks all these guys run our tubulars and that's all they race on, that's all they ride. But Kaylee told me today that a certain clincher is faster than a tubular. And can you make sense of that for us?
It's true, yeah. So actually, I was just overlooking at Tony's bike 5 minutes ago, and he's running tubulars. So Specialized may have misled me on that one.
We'll be able to switcheroo.
Yeah,
I've got a little tech factoid for you, Kaylee. You can use this. I was chatting to someone at Team Sky the other day, and they reckon they've had fewer punctures than any other team at this tour. 4 punctures the whole tour.
Really?
And they think that is because their mechanics work harder. They would say that, wouldn't they? But they say their mechanics are always last in. They also don't have a tire sponsor, which is a deliberate decision, so they choose their own tires, and if there's any nicks or cuts or anything, they replace them immediately. I'm sure all teams think they've got the best mechanics, but I don't know if this is something you've observed.
I'm not sure mechanics can really prevent you from having flats, but the tires certainly can. They're running FMBs, which are a really popular tire for Paris-Roubaix. They run a smaller version for regular road racing, obviously, but yeah, they're running 25mm FMBs, and I would guess that they're probably aging them, which is something that people did with tubulars a lot. Armstrong, for example, notoriously would never ride a tire. I don't know who you're talking about. Riders from 10 years ago would never ride a tire that was less than about 2 years old, and I, from what I've heard, the Sky Mechanics are aging their FMBs.
Armstrong never punctured, actually, did he? I can't remember him puncturing.
And that's one of the things that he says, is he believes, and his mechanics believe, that because they age the tires, which essentially hardens the rubber a little bit, that's why they weren't puncturing. And
in terms of Sky
could be doing the same thing.
In terms of, you know, trying to spot new things, a lot of teams, I guess, are not going to advertise innovations sometimes, are they? Or is it a case of going around and really having a really close look at the bikes as they're unveiled here?
It all depends on the sponsor, really. The teams would like to hide the innovations. Generally, the sponsors want to tout them. So if it's an innovation that is, hey, we have a new wheel, we have a new frame, then the sponsor is going to certainly sort of, like Bianchi, they just set up this big show over there for their new bike. But stuff like the FMB tires that are sort of a mechanics trick, no, they're not going to tell anybody about that. Although most mechanics would know things like that.
We're aging tires like wine, really.
Yeah, just like wine. It's definitely not a proven It's not a proven science, but supposedly it works. I mean, people were doing it for a long, long, long time. It's only in the last couple of years that it's sort of gone out of favor. You know, I think there's probably something to it.
There's a lot of superstition that goes around, though, in the Peloton, isn't there? Like, the other day I heard that Nibali has only worn two yellow jerseys.
Really?
The entire tour. Yeah. And somebody else, I forget who it was, only brought three pairs of socks.
Mollema. Baka
Mollema.
Yeah. Who, by the way, only rode his brand new Bianchi Tantra bike for 10 minutes prior to racing it today.
Very old school.
The bike wasn't quite ready in June, and obviously since he's been at the tour, has not had a chance to ride it except for about 10 minutes at the first rest day.
Wow. Well, Kaylee, I can tell you're champing at the bit to go around sniffing around more bikes. You know, everybody's quite flat. It's the end of the tour. Time trial days have a different pace to them, a different intensity, and everybody is kind of switching off, apart from you tech guys who are just this is your Champs-Élysées, this is your Tourmalet, this is your cobbled stage, all in one. This is your Yorkshire Grande Park, all in one, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. It'll probably be one of the biggest stories on Velen is the entire month is the gallery that I put up later today. So Whoa. Here we go.
Go to work, Kaylee.
Lots of work.
You're listening to the Velo News Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.
Marcel Kittel won the final stage of the Tour de France on the Champs-Élysées. That was his fourth stage win of the race. Vincenzo Nibali wrapped up the overall, becoming the first Italian to win the Tour de France since Marco Pantani in 1998. But it wasn't just about the men on Paris's most famous boulevard on Sunday afternoon. There was also the inaugural edition of La Course, a criterium race for the best women riders in the world. And Marianne Vos, the Dutch multiple world champion, multi-discipline world champion, who took the sprint finish. It was a very narrow victory over Kirsten Wild, but she won nevertheless. And afterwards, we caught up with Marianne just to ask her about the race.
Marianne, can you sum up what it means to you to win on the Champs-Élysées and how important this is for women's cycling in general?
Well, the biggest win of today is the world is watching women's cycling and the beauty of women's cycling. And that ASO gives us this stage to show it. But of course, from the start till the finish, it's just another bike race. And we with Rebel Live wanted to show our best and show what we're showing every week, interesting racing. And I'm really happy that I could finish this up.
Marianne, it perhaps doesn't look like the most challenging course, laps around the Champs. Can you just talk to us about the unique challenges of that circuit?
Well, yeah, it's a different style of racing because it's really wide, and then you have the cobbles, slightly uphill to the Arc de Triomphe. It's difficult to get away because the speed is really high, and in the bunch you're at ease, but in front you're pushing really hard. So we knew that up front. And with the men's, it's often a bench sprint, nearly always. We try to make a hard race, to keep in control, to keep the initiative. But and I had to save my legs for the finish. And that was the challenge. The challenge is to be in the right position at the right moment.
In terms of the women's calendar, we had the Giro Rosso, which clashes, of course, with the Tour de France. Do you feel that takes away some of the spotlight from the women's racing? And do you think that UCI needs to get together with race organisers to dovetail the women's calendar with men's events so that you get higher profile when you're racing in your top races?
These talks are already going on, and that's definitely a challenge. We have beautiful races in the UCI Women's World Cup. We have great races like the Giro Rosa. And now you see here in the combination with the Tour de France, with La Course, that it gets a lot of attention, and that the fans and women, but also men around the world, are willing to see more of women's cycling. So it's a challenge to get a more balanced calendar, and I hope it can be more combined with the men, because that gives us the stage that women's cycling needs to step up further. So this was a great day for women's cycling.
Marianne, before today you've won pretty much everything in women's cycling. There's a new race today, you've won that as well, so you have won everything. Is it hard to carry, to stay motivated, but also to keep improving? Is it hard for for you to, you know, feel like you're still working on things and still becoming a better rider?
Definitely new races motivate us to go further and to improve myself. And this year, with the coming Tour of Britain, the women's tour, with La Course, so much is happening in women's cycling that gives an extra boost and helps me also to stay focused and to stay motivated. It's not really difficult because the competition is getting stronger and stronger, and to be able to stay up there and to catch up also in the team. My teammates are doing so well that you have to have a really good level, high level, to be able to race for the victory. It's great to win these races, but it also helps me to stay fresh.
You're listening to the Velo News Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.
Well, an American didn't win the Tour de France or quite get onto the podium, but there was an American as part of Vincenzo Nibali's backup team. Chris Baldwin is an American who is the team's PR man, and he spent the past 3 weeks fielding the various requests from the media for interviews, not just with Nibali, but also the team principal, Alexander Vinokourov, and the other riders. And the spotlight is always pretty intense on the team that has the yellow jersey, so he's had his hands full, that's for sure. Well, a couple of months ago, when things weren't quite so hectic for him, we caught up with Chris Baldwin, and we wanted to find out a little bit about how an American came to be doing the PR for a Kazakh team. He also offered some insights into Vinokourov's character and shed a bit of light on the culture in this Kazakh squad. So this is Chris Baldwin, who Richard Moore and I spoke to at the Giro d'Italia a couple of months ago.
I suppose it all goes back to the Nagano Winter Olympics, because I went to the University of Montana in the sports press bar just on Hunter Avenue, I think, somewhere in Missoula, Montana. And every Thursday for the previous 5 years, my Russian class, because I was a Russian major in college, had gathered at this sports bar to drink beer with our lone Russian professor. It was an Irish-American named Phil Maloney from San Francisco, who was famous for his union organizing abilities in the Faculty Senate and famous for his long drunken Thursdays that he would spend with Russian language students, no matter the age, in this bar. And so after 4 years of doing this with him, we kind of got to know him, and we kind of knew that in the first hour of the Russian hour, every Thursday, he'd speak Russian and practice and drink beer. And then in the second hour, you'd stop speaking Russian, but you'd still be drinking beer. And then in the third hour, you just stop speaking, and the beer would just flow, and you just keep doing it. And after 4 years, this was how it went.
Just an effective way to learn Russian.
This is why the University of Montana is such a powerhouse in the Russian language instruction in the world. And what happened with Phil Maloney was that he was about 56 years old, 57 years old, and he loved the Republic of Ireland. It was the most important thing in the world to him. Philip Maloney, Catholic family, San Francisco. I think he'd only been here 3 or 4 times. He hadn't really explored it, but it was just his big thing. And so in the Nagano Olympics, if you'll recall, and I'm sure you do, the 4-man bobsled Irish team in the qualifying heats finished 13th or 14th. Enough to be on television. And so there we sat on the Thursday in February in 1998 as the Irish bobsled team on television above us, above our heads in this sports press bar, began to take to the tracks. This was about hour 2.5, so we're already speaking English. A buddy of mine, I think he looked over at Phil, he said, "Hey, look, Irish bobsled team." And Phil looked up at the screen, gave sort of the Phil Maloney chortle. Irish bobsled team had a massive heart attack and died. Fell to the floor. He was dead before he hit the floor. And we were a little bit shocked because he'd never pulled a prank like that before on us, of all the things he had done. And with Phil Maloney went all the collected knowledge in his head that was going to help get me a job in Moscow at the end of 1998. This was before any of the financial crisis had hit. And he had promised me, he said, "Chris, oh, you're a good Russian speaker. We'll send you to Moscow. I know some guys there. You get a job. You'll probably make $50,000 a year." Which at the time was like, wow, $50,000. I'm going to be able to drink beer for hours. And so,
long story short, here you are at Astana.
Here I am.
Sorry, we kind of met there.
Phil died. And I didn't have a job. I didn't know what I was going to do. So I went next door, because I also have a degree in linguistics. I went next door to the linguistics department, and I asked them, have you got something for me? They said, yeah, you can go to Russia and teach English. We have this Soros Fund money. Teach English. It's called the SPELT program, Soros Professional English Language Teaching Program. And they had a choice on a big wall of all these places you could go. And you could go to, in Russia, you could go to Samara, you could go to Taliyadi, you could go to some more Siberian cities, and you could teach English there. And I didn't want to go to Russia, because I'd been to Russia once already, and all I remembered from Russia was how terribly drunk I was all the time, and how much vodka it took to do that, which wasn't that much. And I thought, I don't want to go back to Russia, because by God, I can't control myself with the vodka. I'm just not going to make it. I should go to, I know, a Central Asian country where they're Islamic and they don't drink. So I chose on this big list of the three major Central Asian countries, which were Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, and Kyrgyzstan. I choose to go to Kyrgyzstan. I taught English in Kyrgyzstan, which is the tiny country that's just below Kazakhstan. And what I found out is that, A, they don't really speak Russian there. They speak Kyrgyz, their own language. It's a Central Asian language related to Turkish. And they drink twice as much vodka as the Russians do. And so I spent a year there, generally avoiding vodka, which means avoiding people, and also means drinking beer instead. But I came to really understand Central Asia. And Central Asia, despite the fact that it's three or four different countries, depending on how you look at it, the culture, especially in the post-Soviet sphere, is quite similar. The Kazakhs' proto-culture, the larger culture, is quite similar to the Kyrgyz culture, quite similar to the Uzbeks' culture. And the food is almost the same, almost everywhere. And so what happened was, because I was teaching English there for a year... Plov, exactly. Plov. So you've been there, you know it.
No, I've eaten in a Kazakhstan restaurant in London.
Famous for its parking.
You know it?
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, it was very nice, but sorry, I interrupted.
No, it's I welcome your interruptions, because sometimes I forget what I'm talking about.
That's fine.
Anyway, so what happened in Kyrgyzstan was that I stayed a year, and I really liked it. And I stayed in this town called Osh, which, if you look on a map, Osh is somewhere in the 15th century. You can't miss it. And I moved the second year I moved to Bishkek, which is about in the 1950s. It's okay. But it's an alpine city, and it's more like my native Montana, and I really, really enjoyed living there. But after 2 years there, where my salary went from $200 a month to $300 a month, I was like, I need a challenge. I'm going to go somewhere. So I went up to Moscow, and I went working up in Moscow, and I took a job at a business newspaper there because I spoke English, and I knew a little bit about the internet.
You spoke English?
I did. At the time, I did. And it's been downhill ever since. And what happened was, I started working as a journalist, and I got a job in this thing, and I was making $1,200 a month living in Moscow in about 2000. And that just wasn't that much money.
Journalism.
Yeah, long story short, I decided I needed to go get a credential in journalism. So I went back to the United States, I applied for graduate schools, and in 2005, I finally had the cash to do it, so I went back to the United States for 1 year, got a graduate degree in journalism, and immediately found work, because I was a Russian speaker. But I didn't find work doing what I wanted to do, which was to come back to Kazakhstan, which was to come back to Central Asia, which was to come back to see all these cultures. Instead, I found a job with the Reuters news agency, first to spend a year in London, and then to go to Moscow. And when I got to Moscow, it was a return, but the prices had gone from where you could live at $1,200 a month to where your rent wasn't even $1,200 a month. And I spent a year and was doing things like politics. I covered the Champions League championship. You remember when it was there? It was against Chelsea and Manchester, yeah. And that game was rained the entire time, and there were more cops than spectators, it seemed, at one point. What happened is, at the end, I spent a year in Moscow. I thought I was going to spend many years there, but Reuters, because they were led by a man named Michael Stott, who deserves to die because he's a terrible man, he moved me back to London. He said, no, I don't remember ever telling you were going to stay in London or signing a contract with you that you would be here for this long. So they sent me back to London. And I got very, very bored in London. Because you guys have been to London. You know how it is. It's a wonderful place. But after a while...
Fantastic Kazakhstan restaurant.
It does, I guess. I lived in South London. I lived in a place called Greenwich for a while.
Yeah.
And then just across the hill in Blackheath. I found a place in Blackheath where they found my accent charming, and they said I could live. And it was okay, but after 2 years I was bored, and I really wanted to go back to Moscow or Russia. So I found this other job. I found a job with Bloomberg, the big competitor for Reuters. And on the day I went to tell Reuters that I was quitting and going to Bloomberg, and the day I quit, I got a phone call totally unexpected from a guy named Vasily Davidenko, who's a Russian-American, who was running a team called Team Type 1 at the time. And he said, hey, Chris, I got a budget for a team. We're going to race in Europe. We're at a pro-continental level. We need a press officer. Are you interested? And I thought back, and I'd known Vasily for about 10 years, because in America, when I had lived there, I'd always gone to these bike races. And I'd done work for Cycling News. I covered the Criterium Champions 1 year. And I wasn't a terribly good cycling journalist, because I would write way too many words for a
Criterium. I don't believe that.
You can't be wordy. The one thing that Reuters taught me is that you really have to distill it into one sentence per paragraph, and you really have to cut it down like that. But anyway, Vasily called me up and said, I need somebody to do this press officer thing. And I had no idea about PR or internet or anything, but it was a lot like that same move that I made from Kyrgyzstan to Moscow when I just started working at a newspaper. Yeah, I'll do it. And so I did it for 2 years with Vasily at Team Type 1, and that was a really interesting project because they had these six or seven kids with diabetes who were racing, and all these other guys. And in our first year, we didn't have so much success. We won the Tour of Turkey, but in our second year, we did really well at the Tour of Austria, and we did really well with races all around the world. And it was a really good project. But what happened was the sponsor changed for Team Type 1, and they were taken from their old sponsor to a new sponsor, Novo Nordisk. And one of the stipulations in the change was that they were going to go to be an all-diabetic squad. And that changes the dynamic of the kinds of invitations that they're going to get to the races that they're going to go to, at least in the first few years. And I kind of thought, well, wait a minute. I like the team. I like the project. These are good friends of mine. I really want to do this. But why don't I try and seek my way up? And so what happened was, at the Tour of Turkey that year, in the second stage, two riders went in a breakaway. One of them was Laszlo Bodrogi, our guy, and the other guy was Alexander Vinokurov, who's the leader of this Astana team. And so what happened, the way I got this job, was those two guys went in the break. Bodrogi took the points for the beauty jersey that you get in the Tour of Turkey, and Vinokurov got the most aggressive rider jersey. And you know, in the Tour of Turkey, there's like 7 or 8 podium presentations every day. And so what happened was, I went up and I stood next to Vinokurov. And Vinokurov's a small, diminutive man, but he's nonetheless terrifying. Most people are just absolutely petrified of the guy because, he looks like he could just sort of... like a chocolate bunny. Yeah. And I just started talking to him. I said, hey, Bodrogi broke his leg too. Because this was in... Alexander Vinokurov was building his leg back up. And he looked at me... First of all, he looked at me like, what strange man is speaking Russian to me? How is this possible? And then he relaxed a little bit. And I said, yeah, he broke his leg. Bodrogi broke his leg, but he didn't get the chance to recover. And so he's had struggled trying to come back in. But, hey, you're looking good, And he's like, oh, yeah. And then he started telling me, he's like, they put a spike in my leg this long. I got French guys doing it. It's awesome. I'm going to, I'm training this year. I'm going to get back in and try and race again. And I said, oh, cool. He said, oh, cool. What's your name? And I'm Chris. Oh, see you later, Chris. And then that night, Vasily comes up to me at the restaurant. He's like, I got really good news for you, Chris. What is it, Vasily? Astana wants to hire you.
On the basis of that one conversation?
More or less. Because they're like, oh, God, here's a guy who speaks Russian. Oh, my God, he speaks Russian. He can do this job. And what happened, it turns out, Vasily Davidenko is a really good friend of Alexander Schaefer, who is the director sportif of this team. And because they're such good friends, Vasily was able to vouch for me in more or less a second and say, oh, yeah, Chris is a good guy. He knows what he's doing. Also, he wants to leave us because he kind of wants a promotion. And that's how it worked out.
Now you're here.
And now I'm here.
And how does it work? I mean, how much contact, how many dealings do you have with the Kazakh sponsors of the team? Because this is a team that's been around for a long time now, but... It's still quite opaque to the outside world. I mean, it's your job to make it less so, isn't it? So, but how does it work? With there are sort of several partners sponsoring it. Yeah. How much do you have to do with them?
Well, the really good parallel is if you know that about the Sovereign Welfare Fund of Norway, and because Norway was a relatively poor country before the discovery of offshore gas and oil, and they're a country that has this mentality, it's a rather conservative mentality of, let's do things right in Norway. They created the Sovereign Welfare Fund, and now it's one of the richest nations per capita in the world. Kazakhstan is trying to mimic that. And they've created the Sovereign Welfare Fund. It's called Samruk Kazina. And what they're doing is they're going around investing their billions that they're making in things like oil and gas and uranium and plutonium and aluminum and eventually agriculture, because they're going to open this huge, this big bread basket that they used to have in the Soviet Union. They're going to open it up, and then they're just going to supply everybody with bread. excuse me. What's going to happen, or what is happening, is that they handle all of this investment internally, and they're building roads, and they're building hospitals, and they're building things up, and schools, and whatnot. And they're also somewhat responsible for their image outside the country. And the president of the country has given them this mandate, hey, improve our image outside the country as well. And so they, if you think about it, honestly, really the only thing most people know about Kazakhstan is two things. Any savvy sort of Westerner, they know Borat the movie, and they know Alexander Vinokurov and the bike team. And depending on their level of sophistication, they can see that the movie Borat really isn't about Kazakhstan at all, but about Alexander Vinokurov and Kazakhstan, because nobody's ever really spoken up for them and said, hey, we're English, or this guy's a Russian speaker, but he's part of our world tour, world two. The people kind of look at him like, what is this mystery guy? And so they have this team, but it's not really about Alexander Vinokurov. It's about the Kazakh Cycling Federation in general. And so what happened was that in the Soviet period, there was this really strong amateur cycling program that existed all throughout the country, and they could race internally. And it was a selection process. It was entirely state-funded, and it existed in hundreds of cities in Russia, and then dozens of cities in all the other republics as well. In Kazakhstan, it seemed to exist stronger than anywhere else. Partly because the climate is relatively mild and they could train and race a lot more, but also because a lot of the guys who were really good trainers in Kazakhstan, they had all of the conditions were met in their life. They had good food, they had good land, they had good bicycles, they had money in order to do things, and they had an active network where they could go around and race all the time. And so they would start racing in Tajikistan, or they would start racing in Turkmenistan in January, a lot like racing in Spain in January. And they would race all the way through, and they would just get stronger and stronger. So what happened is that in the Soviet period, most of the guys who were making the final Soviet team were actually from Kazakhstan. And Kazakhstan was always the Belgium of Soviet cycling. What happened when that collapsed is that infrastructure network was still there, but there was no funding anymore. Some of the guys who were particularly strong, they got funding from their families. Their families sold the car so they could come in. Muravyov is one of them now, who's still racing. But Vinokurov was another one. Schaefer was in the last generation of Soviet cyclists. Sadun, who's a director here, was also in the last generation of Soviet cyclists. They came over. They lived in their cars. They lived in East German dormitories. They raced for Criterium Primes, and they raced for noodles. And they just kind of got to this point where they're like, God, this is really hard. We don't want to race like this anymore. And so when the nation of Kazakhstan started to develop its resources, these guys who were in the Cycling Federation went to them. And they had a really powerful ally. The guy who was the prime minister of the country was also the president of the Cycling Federation. And he helped them get funding. And they kept going around and winning races. And so they get more funding. And they win more races and they get more funding. And then when Liberty Seguros's license became available, like suddenly in the middle of the season, Astana.
2006, wasn't it?
Yeah, 2005, 2006. They turned to Astana. They said, hey, you got the money? You want to buy a license? And they ponied up quickly. They said, we got it. And they got the license. And then all of a sudden they had this license. What are we going to do with it? What they started to do was they went back to the government. They said, look, this is a really good promotion vehicle for the nation of Kazakhstan. It's pleasant. People are always smiling at bike races. It's not like football where it's you're for Real Madrid or you're for Barcelona. It's everybody's for all bicycle racing around the world. Let's do it that way. And they began to promote it, and they're getting bigger and bigger. And then as those promotional things increased, the people in Kazakhstan who know how to do promotion, they also increased. Their cadres increased as well. And so they got more sophisticated and did more things. And so, like 2 years ago, 3 years ago, they said, "Well, here's what we want to do. We want to host this thing called Expo 2017, which is the World Expo, the World Trade Fair. I'm probably getting a name wrong, but Expo 2017 is what it's called." And they bid against Liège, Belgium. And it's a bidding process, just like the Olympics is, just like the football is, just like everything else is. And they got it in their minds that, okay, we're going to have this World Expo because it's a chance for us to show off what we're doing. And it's really interesting because Semru Kazina has, this larger mission of, as a sovereign welfare fund, of providing for the nation and building it up. But then at some point, when they've sort of done that and they've got the infrastructure up and running, then they've got to take their money and create a bond market. because the money's still there and they've got to keep that money active, but they've got to create a bond market. So they're doing all these things to create a really stable banking system and a really positive banking economy, sort of set themselves up as this hub of banking somewhere between China and the Middle East. And they're like, but nobody knows about it. I said, well, we'll use the expo to, you know, fundamentally advertise our ability to create a bond market, you know, a national bond market. And at the same time, we'll use the cycling team to promote the expo. So they sort of see it as this stepping stone of levels that they're going to go through. So right now, the bike team, and we've got this big Expo 2017 thing on the side of our bus, and it's on the jerseys as well. But what it is this active construction project that's going on. And it's all these, you know, Norman Foster, Hilary Swank, whatever the architects' names are, Renzo Panani.
I mean, Hilary Swank is an architect, but
that's a good name for an architect.
It is. But does that? I mean, is the long term future of the team assured?
We're assured through 2017 for sure.
That's right, 2017.
Yeah, but they've also built this new thing called the Astana Presidential Club, which they're trying to model on like FC Barcelona or FC Real or Galatasaray, where they create an umbrella group of lots of different sports teams all in the same group.
Right.
And that's what they're doing. So Astana, the capital city of Kazakhstan, is cold and windy and kind of terrible in December, you know, much like, you know, Ottawa or Winnipeg or something like that. But in the summer, it's quite nice. In the summer, it's quite pleasant. But it's got all of this modern architecture. It's got, you know, 400 or 500 brand new buildings that are just freaky, and they're not Dubai freaky. They're like, oh, cool freaky. You know? How is this a building?
I mean, Vinokurov is somebody, again, who's probably quite a misunderstood figure, or not very well understood guy in a lot of the cycling world. He is a sort of symbol of cycling's past. He's the guy who, you know, failed the drugs test in 2007, wasn't it? Honestly, how do you get on with Vinokurov? Do you feel he is misunderstood? Because,
yeah,
you know, there are other guys who fail drug tests who don't have the image that Vinokurov has.
I think probably the best thing to say is that there's a Billy Bragg line where he says, all revolutions are not the same. They're as different as the cultures give them birth. No one idea has something on earth. Basically, that's it. Punishment and repentance are not the same in all nations. They're the same for sport, but the guy sat out for 2 years. He sat out his band for 2 years. What he didn't do is he didn't do David Millar and write a book about it. And what he didn't do is he didn't provide a mea culpa at the end of it. And I think that there's a mentality in the world that says, well, you have to do that. That's the only way to get back in. In Kazakhstan, that is not the prevailing mentality. The mentality is, okay, you were punished, and you've served it, and now you can come back. Come back and win something and show us that you've come back. And so Vinokurov's a very smart guy. And he came back and he won the Olympics. And to the Cycling Federation of Kazakhstan, that's the apology. That's the plea for redemption. But it's not a, please forgive me, I was bad. It's a, I'm back. I am back. And it's a, in Kazakhstan, that's how it plays. In the United Kingdom, it plays differently. In America, it plays completely differently. It plays different in different parts of the world. In Italy, I'd say it's a little bit closer. But what I've come to learn about cycling in Europe is that it's a sport that, in terms of the doping question and the return and forgiveness, is almost seen along the lines of Catholics versus Protestants. Whereas the Protestants say, no, you've sinned, you're bad, and you're not ever to be redeemed, and the Catholics say, eh, que cosa fai, no problem, you say sorry, everybody come back. And I know that's like a really rough oversimplification of things, but I think that applies to the larger world as well. And it's certainly
to the prevailing cultures of those countries.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
How does that affect your job then? Because you're obviously the kind of one of the faces of the team, you're liaising with media from all of these different countries. Do you have to kind of subtly sort of massage that message? Or
really? No, because the message, I think, is the same everywhere. The thing is that in Kazakhstan, there is cycling media, but it's not guys. I mean, you guys are making a living doing this. It's not guys who are making a living in Kazakhstan as cycling media. They're covering all sports. And so those kinds of things don't come up. In Italy, the press, there are elements of the press that chase that down and do that, but they cover all of cycling. You know how big cycling is in Italy. It's really in the few times I come with it, it's really only in the English language media that we go back to Vinokurov's past and we go back to questions of the past. Cycling in a large part, I think, is making all of these changes to you know, as an institution, to go back and prove all of that stuff. So it's not really so much my job. It's, you know, I could just point to the MPCC sticker and say, well, we're doing this, you know. And we've got our own anti-doping program set up with our own doctors as well. And then, you know, the whereabouts system, which just keeps everybody on their toes. There are all of these nice elements that you can just point to and say, well, here you go, these are the elements that are in place. At some point, it'll be something like, well, you know, can we get a proctological exam of these guys? You know, can we go in further? Can we go in deeper? And I think that's the point where you have to say, look, these are the elements, and this is the square we've drawn around it, and this is what we have. Let's go back and focus on the racing. Let's go back and look at how we're going to build, you know, the next generation of cycling, how we're going to set up things like a riders' union that's going to fight for its own rights and that's going to do things like you know, help control organizers from setting up 13 mountain stages in a 3-week stage race, and who's gonna keep you know, press conferences to a minimum at the end of a stage race so that they're not getting wiped out in the recovery process, et cetera, et cetera. Those, I think those are the issues that are eventually going to come up, and those are the things that the riders mostly talk about these days. You know, how they're going to survive as the sport gets bigger, as the sport starts to make more money, as the organizers sort of realize, hey, we've got you know, we've got this tremendous asset, and once, you know, the Sky Television is going to get involved and start broadcasting it around the world, people are going to realize, okay, everybody's got to start going forward now and making sure that we're all getting a piece of this pie and we're all getting to share and distribute this, you know, income that hopefully eventually is going to come in and keep the sport alive and then help it to grow.
So how does Vincenzo Nibali kind of take the Kazakh message to the world? Obviously, he won the Giro d'Italia last year. This year, he's going to try and win the Tour de France. He's up there in, you know, the sort of two or three favourites, isn't he? In terms of being the figurehead of the team, how is he to work with, and what's he like as a guy? Because we don't know so much about him, because we've not spoken to him. He doesn't speak great English. But what's he like?
He's very quiet. He's very Italian. He lives in Lugano, but he's you know, Italian at heart. He likes photography. His dad's a professional photographer. He just has a brand new baby daughter. I think he would rather spend time at home with his wife and daughter than anything else. But the way he carries this message of Expo 2017 to the world is by winning these big races. And, you know, Vinokurov, for all of his bluntness, did this very sort of bold thing. He said, I'm going to take over general management of the team, and we're going to win the Giro d'Italia. He told that to the Kazakh management, and they did it. They came through on the goal that they established for them. That builds a lot of confidence in those circles. The sponsor said, okay, what's next? So we're going to go win the Tour de France. That remains to be seen if that's going to happen. I mean, we had a spring that was difficult for everybody, but it was difficult for everybody. It wasn't difficult just for our team. And we've got, I don't know, how many, 2 more months to train and get ready for it. And that's how he's going to do it. That's how Vincenzo Nibali is going to do it, and how Astana team in general is going to do it.
Okay. Well, I was just going to ask, where does Ciro live on the bus? Because Ciro is a very good friend of the podcast.
Ciro, he doesn't live on the bus, but I can tell you the one thing about Ciro is that we did this. I'll tell you the story about Ciro. What happened was we wanted to do a pave reconnaissance after Tour of Roubaix, because all of our assets were up in place. Our van was in place. All of our Roubaix bikes were in place. All the wheels were in place in just outside of Ghent. And we were going to go do this Roubaix recon after Roubaix was all over. And I don't know if you saw the clown circus that was on Monday when Contador did his recon. But there were like 37 motorcycles following him around. Like, hey, Contador, hey, you're bouncing, hey. And it freaked everybody out, duly. What I remember from 2 years ago, Roubaix itself, reconnaissance, was that Cancellara was knocked down by all of those motorcycles that were following him. And I didn't want any of that happening, so I was trying to keep it as quiet as possible. And Ciro, genius reporter that he is, Cub Scout reporter Ciro, went up to Stefano Zanini and said, hey, are you going home after Roubaix? He says, yeah, but then I got to come back. Oh, why are you coming back? Oh, we got to do reconnaissance of Roubaix with Vincenzo on Wednesday at 9:30 in this parking lot. And So, of course, I see that on, that comes out on Twitter like 20 minutes later, and Chiro's like, I found out, and I think you retweeted it. You're like, oh, the genius, the Everest, or no, Freebie did it. And I was like, oh, crap, we're going to have this thing. And so I tried to put this, like, kibosh on it and shut it down. And, like, Alessandro Di Stefano flew in to do it. Claudio Giuseberti flew in to do it. All these guys, they flew in to catch this. All these Italian guys wanted to do it because they want to see Vincenzo doing it. We had our own photographer. We had our own video crew to do it. And we kind of wanted nobody else there. But thanks to Chiro, the Italian public knows exactly how well Vincenzo Nibali can ride the pavé at Roubaix.
Oh, good old Chiro. He's a good friend of the podcast. We have him on regularly. So finally, Chris, can you give us a prediction for the season in Russian?
Да, хорошо. Я думаю, что в этом году, кто победит на Tour de France, конечно, будет команда Astana Pro Team. И на второе место я ожидаю, может быть, хороший результат от американского гонщика TJ Van Garderen.
So that was Chris Baldwin. He'll be taking a well-earned break, I'm sure, for a couple of weeks at least, but I expect he'll be back on duty at the Vuelta, which starts towards the end of August. He said that this is the fifth Grand Tour that he's done as PR man for Astana, and the first was when Nibali won the Giro. So he's had a very busy 18 months or so. Well, that's about it from us. We'd just like to say thanks to everyone at Velo News for the association that they've had with the cycling podcast these past 3 weeks. In particular, we'd like to thank Neil Rogers, the editor of Velo News, and particularly Andy Hood and Matt Bowden, their excellent writers who have been such great guests on the podcast during the Tour de France. So from Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb and I, thank you very much for listening, and hopefully we'll see you again next July.
You're listening to the Velo News Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.